This is a CBC podcast.
Well, hi there. I'm Gian Gomeshi, inviting you to enter the world of arts, cultural affairs, and entertainment with Q's video podcast. Feature interviews with the people and personalities shaping, captivating, and challenging culture. Delivered to your mobile device 3 times a week, visit cbc.ca/Q to subscribe to the Q video podcast and watch what we're doing.
One.
This is your life.
You can imagine that if you can talk to a traffic signal and there's no cars coming the other way, why should I stop?
Two.
This is your digital life.
You know, if you think back before all this, either people were together or they were separate.
Three.
I don't think that the world's quite ready for that yet. I think that's just a little bit on the freaky side for most people.
This is Spark.
Two, five.
cbc.ca/spark.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This time on Spark, does distance matter? You know when you're driving on the highway at 100 kilometers an hour and you look at the cars speeding past you and there's no one driving any of them? No? Well, some car manufacturers are promising nearly autonomous cars by 2020. We get beyond the hype for a look at what self-driving cars would mean for the future of cities and your commute. And ever since George and Jane Jetson, we've been looking for video phones that can bridge distance. These days, we have cheap off-the-shelf options for doing just that. So why does working remotely still feel so remote? Can tech replace working together? Location, location, location on Spark. The other day, I walked into the Spark studio, as I often do. And as I made my way to the microphone, I heard a sound. That sound was coming from an iPhone sitting on a music stand. Then suddenly I heard a voice.
Hey, Nora, you got a sec?
And on the screen I saw a face. I got a little closer and said hi to Danny Robinson. Hi, Danny, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Great, thanks. What do you want? The iPhone I was talking into was running a piece of software called Perch, and Danny Robinson, the guy on the other end, is Perch's CEO. Perch is based in Vancouver, and it's billed as a live, always-on video portal. Here's how it works. You mount an iPad or an iPhone to a wall in your workplace, then use the Perch software to connect to Perch software on other iPads or iPhones mounted on walls in other places. As Danny told me, it's kind of like having a little window into a remote colleague's office.
Like a regular window you'd see in a normal office, except for in this window, the people might be 3,500 miles away. Or, in fact, we've got lots of users who use it just between floors in the same building.
Mm-hmm.
So it just keeps teams together.
And so you and I mean, I'm looking at a little iPhone here, and I can see you in Vancouver, and I can see a little bit of me in the corner. But how? And we're having conversation, but how is that different from just having like a Skype video chat thing up and just keeping it running 24/7.
The big differences are, of course, is that we built Perch from the ground up to stay on all the time. It's designed to work within a network of, say, you know, upwards of hundreds of these devices all within the same network. And they have a very intelligent back end that decides which device should connect to which other device to create that experience. It uses machine learning to figure out, oh, this design team in California is always talking to the design team in Boston, so let's make sure those are the guys are connected the most. And then the other huge difference that makes it work in an office environment is that the mic is normally muted, so you can't hear all the background noise. When you walk up to the device, it actually notices that you're there using facial detection and activates the mic automatically so you can have your conversation. And when you're done, you just walk away and it automatically mutes itself again. So to the rest of the office, it's not annoying or distracting in the background.
So there's this design trend out there that sometimes is called ambient awareness, which refers to this idea that we can have this kind of peripheral social awareness. So how does Perch fit into that idea?
Because you're on and it's a window, it's always there. The office knows it. They, in the background, in the back of their head, they know, oh, over there is the, you know, the design team in Boston. And that's just them. I mean, it's just as if they're in, you know, the next room. You know, and that's the feeling, the specific feeling we're trying to create is if they're right there. If I over the corner of my eye, I see Bob in Boston, I can walk up and say, hey, Bob, what's going on? And Bob can turn his head, look at the device, activates his microphone, and says, oh, hey, Dan, how you doing? It's like, oh, yeah, we're wondering if you got that design for the client. You know, yeah, yeah, send it over next week. Cool. Stuff like those impromptu water cooler type conversations just don't happen in any other medium. And that's what we're trying to create.
Yeah. We talked on the show before to the human-computer interaction expert, Bill Buxton, and he talks about the problem of trying to replicate virtually what we naturally do as human beings, right? Where if I walk by your office and I see, you know, you got your head down, you're frantically typing on the computer, well, I'm not going to bother you unless the building's on fire, right? Because I can see you're busy.
Right, right.
So how do you recreate that if you're trying to do things virtually? So how do you think this works to sort of replicate what it's like to actually work in an office with somebody?
First, I'll say that there's this, some people are trying to create this concept of an ambient experience at the desk, like right always on at my desk. I don't think that the world's quite ready for that yet. I think that's just a little bit on the freaky side for most people. Like, think of Perch as a device that would be installed on the wall outside of a pod of cubicles or outside of a team space. That would be the perfect space where they can kind of see everybody all at once and not one specific person.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it would be the same as if I walked up to that pod of cubicles and sort of said, hey, you know, with a bunch of other people around, I might say, you know, hey, Mara, how are you doing? You know, can I ask you a quick question? You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. That is the experience it feels like when you use Perch set up, you know, as an always-on device.
Mm-hmm. Danny, thanks so much for talking to us.
No problem. Thanks
good
for having me.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Yeah, exactly.
Danny Robinson is the CEO of Perch. Perch, which we just heard about, is one example of an always-on video system, but it's not the first. As I found out, this technology has a long history.
These always-on video systems were first created in like 1988. This was done by Xerox PARC, and they had special video broadcast setups in different workplaces. They had to get a high-quality bandwidth line between these sites, so it was an enormous cost, difficult to maintain, difficult to set up.
This is Saul Greenberg. Saul is a computer science prof at the University of Calgary. He's built these kind of systems in the lab, and over the years, he's seen them make their way into everyday workplaces.
As the costs have come down, it's just become something that all of a sudden has moved out of a research product to something that was commercially attainable to something that's now available to everyday people, because you can take your existing iPad or whatever and just use it.
Yeah. You've worked on two-way ambient video conferencing systems for years now, since the early 1990s. I'm wondering if you can describe the video chat system that you designed back in 1999.
Well, back in that time, we had a system that essentially looked into the environment to try to figure out, is somebody actually there or not? And how can we actually take that information and use it to not only enhance communication by video, but also help assist privacy concerns. So in our particular system, if two people were close to the video setup, you'd see and hear the other person. But as one moved away, the image would start getting blurry, and the fidelity of the sound would also decrease and eventually stop. And the whole idea was to try to create this balance of both privacy, but also a feeling of interconnectivity. And how do we find that sweet spot between the two? And in some ways, I think Perch is trying to do the same thing, because they also try to mute audio depending on whether they recognize someone is in front of their system.
Mm-hmm. So given that the systems that you were working with were designed to be always on, how did they deal with things like privacy or, you know, unwanted crosstalk and things like that?
Well, there's two ways to do this. One is technological, which is one of the approaches that we try. But the other is social, is that people who use these kind of systems in practice actually take a lot of care in where they situate these devices, how they make them publicly visible, how they actually mediate them with their partner on the other side to understand what is good social protocol for using these things. So as a simple example, this is one of the early findings. if somebody has an always-on video connection and then they have a physical visitor to their office, one of the first things they do is they introduce that visitor to the partner on the other side
right.
to let them know that, yes, there is, in fact, another person here who may be overhearing a conversation. So the danger is that we think of these video systems as, oh, here is a surrogate for somebody physically being there. But in actuality, they're not. They're an approximation. And there's a lot of cues that go on in our environment that signal whether another person is there, the level of engagement, whether they're listening, and all those kind of things. And those are easily lost over these video channels. So one has to be careful both technologically and socially to understand how to use these things as part of one's social practice and social culture.
Yeah, can we talk a bit about the sort of human-to-human interaction that goes on there? What are some of the sort of subtle factors in the way that we, you know, do things like bring people into the conversation or exclude people that need to be somehow accounted for when you create one of these systems?
Well, the way I'm going to characterize it is in fact, by the way, sociologists have characterized this, again, back in the 80s, because this is a well-studied phenomenon, and to contrast it to video conferencing. So video conferencing, for example, traditional video conferencing is all about a purposeful meeting. Let's set up a time. We have something, an agenda. Let's actually do it.
Right.
Whereas these always-on video systems are more about casual interaction. And it tries to leverage the same things that happen when you go down a hallway, you bump into your friends, you go into a coffee room, or you know, you walk by somebody's open office, you see somebody there, and you drop in. So they tend to be opportunistic, they tend to be serendipitous, or one person tends to initiate that conversation. The conversation tends to have a lot of social aspects to it. But at the same time, people will be doing things like coordinating with each other. So for example, how's it going? Fine. Well, if you're doing some work together, then you know that they haven't brought up any issues. It's about updating other people about what's going on. It's about actually leading into purposeful work if you want to do that. And it's also about maintaining social connections. And I think that's part of the cultural aspects that the PERCH system is trying to maintain.
Yeah, so what is getting lost when we're mediating our conversations in this way?
Oh, everything. All the subtleties that happen when, for example, you and I populate a physical space. It's the people around us. It's not just about you and me. It's the other people in the setting. It's about us being aware of what the other person is doing, seeing other people do their work or even their pleasurable activities, knowing when people are coming in or going out. All these little things really adds to what's called the common ground of our understanding of each other. And a video link will give you some of that, but it won't give you all of that. And I'll give you an illustration. Back in the late 80s, when Xerox PARC was first doing these, they had a link between Portland and a California site. And people thought that they understood the culture on the other side, what was going on. Yet it turned out that there was some gossip happening at the remote site that wasn't being told over the video channel. And when people at the other site found out about this, they were actually quite upset because they felt excluded from it. So these are those kind of subtle things that, you know, there are things you get when you're in a physical space that you don't actually get over a video channel for a variety of reasons. So it's not, again, it's not all about the technical aspects about it, but a video channel is just a small window into the other world.
Yeah.
And like a small window, it can only serve so many purposes. But again, it's a good thing, right? It does promote casual interactions that wouldn't happen otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other known disadvantages to this kind of always-on video awareness or specific stumbling blocks that people are working on?
Oh, sure. Like the biggest thing, obviously, is privacy. So even though I may want to have one of these connections with you, let's say, if you and I were colleagues and this was sitting in my office, the other people in the workplace may see this as an intrusion where they, you know, if they go by the door and they know that they're on camera or they come into to my office and then they get surprised by you being there. Mm. Some people are very video adverse. They do not want to be captured on a camera at all. And, you know, there's a whole Big Brother aspects of this. There's cultural aspects. So, for example, we have a technology, but there's nothing to stop your boss from saying, you must have one of these in your office, and I'll have this in my office, so you will always be available to me.
Right.
So you can see this becoming kind of an enabler of a fascist kind of system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, more subtly, there's also lots of things that are lost on these channels. For example, I used to have a system where I had an always-on connection between home and work. So where I actually connected with myself, so to speak, so that if people came to my work office when I was working at home, they would see me on a big computer display, you know, facing the door, so they knew I was there, they can come sit down and talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems with this is that people, even though that was my office, people in the outside area thought that this was really strange because somehow I could now spy on what was going on outside of my door, which is really strange because it was my office. So if I was physically there, I'd see exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that it's on video changes, you know, the sense of how people perceive the technology or the communication. So there's lots of dangers in this. Like everything else, it has to be taken into our social fabric. It's not just a piece of technology we'll plop on our desk, but we have to actually understand how to use it. We have to create our own rules that's socially acceptable to our cultures. We have to watch out for intrusions. Like things like Facebook and other media, we can become overwhelmed by the amount of people coming to our space to the point that we actually can't get anything done because we're constantly interrupted. So it's, you know, it's a mixed blessing. Don't think of it as a solution. Think of it as an enabler. And it's up to if people buy something like Perch or similar products, you know, realize it'll take some time to actually get used to it and to adapt it to your culture.
Saul, thanks so much for talking to us.
A pleasure.
Saul Greenberg is a professor of computer science at the University of Calgary. So, an always-on video system gives us a window on the world of our colleagues and promotes the kind of casual interactions that can help us work more effectively and be more productive. The trick is, you want awareness and interaction, but not too much or it just becomes annoying. Turns out that when it comes to sound, a little bit of noise, but not too much, can also have a big effect on our productivity at work. It flies in the face of the view that you have to have silence to get stuff done. Some research has suggested that the right amount of noise at work can enhance creativity. That research even sparked a website called Coffitivity that provides a steady stream of ambient coffee shop sound to give people a creative boost when they need it. And many people seem to like that idea. Time magazine named Coffitivity one of 2013's 50 best websites. But it's a fine line between the creative buzz of people working together and it being just too loud to get any work done. So we thought we'd check in with our favorite sound expert to sort through the noise on the impact of sound on productivity at work.
I'm Julian Treasure. I'm chairman of the Sound Agency. I'm a sound consultant, which actually involves getting organizations to make good sound because they make most of the noise around us. And I'm also author of the book Sound Business. And my vision is to make the world sound beautiful. There may be some people for whom the specific sound of a coffee shop is useful. Some people. You certainly couldn't generalize that. What is true is that whilst one person's voice is very distracting, and if you can hear one person talking, your productivity can be degraded by up to two-thirds. What we find easier to work in is a sound that scientists would call babble. It's stochastic sound. That is to say, lots of events going on, but you can't really discern any of them. Now, a coffee shop might well fall into that category, as long as you can't hear individual conversations. But then so would birdsong, or running water, or wind in leaves, or general office background babble, as long as it's not too loud. Well, creativity generally, and I haven't studied creativity in great detail, but my understanding of it is that in general, people prefer to have a stimulus around them. In other words, if you give a stimulus and some restrictions, so if you give an artist the instruction of make a work of art, they may get rather stuck. If you say, here's a stick and some color and a piece of paper, now make a work of art, they'll get right at it. It's a cathartic input into your process, which may fire off ideas or just make you feel the juices flow and get you in touch with your muse. So music can be very good for creativity. Other sounds can too. I mean, maybe it's about association. A lot of sound works through association. We hear something and we associate it with. Just in the same way, if there have been environments where you felt wildly creative, then if you can recreate the sound of those environments, you will probably stimulate your creativity that way too. Background noise has a huge effect on the way that people can work because you only have bandwidth for 1.6 human conversations. That means if you can hear somebody else talking, and don't forget, we have no ear lids, so it's hard to block that out. They take up one of your 1.6, which leaves you only 0.6 in your head to do that work you're trying to do, construct a report, do mathematics, whatever it is, whatever kind of knowledge work. So if you're trying to do that kind of work, it's really important that you have quiet working space, and this is a huge issue in modern offices where there is a wrong assumption that open plan is suitable for all activities. It simply isn't. Well, I think our listenings are as personal as our fingerprints or our retinas or our voice prints. What is music to me might be noise to you. What's a joyful sound to me might be unbearable to you. We're all individuals, and it's really difficult to make general rules about sound and the way it affects people. So I would just say try various things. If you're sitting at home, some people love silence and they can work really, really well in silence. And I certainly recommend for anybody getting a few minutes of silence a day because it recalibrates your ears, it resets you, and it allows you to listen afresh. But other people find silence intimidating. I guess it's like some people love starting with a blank sheet of paper and other people like to edit. So if that's you and if you don't like silence, try different sounds. I would suggest the class of stochastic sound. So things like birdsong or natural sound, or indeed hubbub from a lot of people talking. And if that makes you feel more connected with, you know, the idea of an office and more productive, great. But it is going to be down to trying out what works for you. What I can say is that for most people, music isn't going to be the right solution, because music calls quite a lot of attention. It's a cognitively dense sound. Most music is made to be listened to, and it's pretty difficult to have it on in the background and not listen to it at all. So part of your cognition, at least, will be listening to the music. It depends on the kind of music. Obviously, if it's very repetitive or very slow-moving, so things like trance or ambient music, they are quite easy to put aside. But if it's doing a lot of stuff, like bebop jazz or classical music or pop with vocals, then it's a lot harder to put aside. You may be able to work longer, you may feel more refreshed, you may have more fun working, but it won't actually help your productivity. There are some sounds which the vast majority of people like. Birdsong, gentle rain outside your window. Those kind of sounds most people find really pleasant. A tip if you are working in a noisy office is to have a pair of headphones and put one of those sounds on. That may well help. But yes, I can see that if you're sitting at home in a quiet environment and you want to create some sense of stimulus or a learned connection with working hard and being part of a team, then the noise of an office, the background sound of an office, could be a very reassuring one to use. Or indeed, a cafe, if that floats your boat. I'm just saying, I think there's been a lot of overclaims about this cafe sound causing people to be creative. That certainly will not be a general rule. It's down to each individual.
Julian Treasure is a sound consultant and chairman of The Sound Agency. He's also the author of the book Sound Business. Personally, I think I might find a coffee shop distracting. When I really have to write, I use a program that shuts out the distractions of all the other programs on my computer while it plays ambient music and the gentle sound of keyboard tapping. Or my go-to ambient music, Brian Eno.
works every time. I'd love to know your tips and tricks for focus and creativity when you've just got to get something done. Share them at the website cbc.ca/spark. Look for episode 225 or find us on Facebook and Twitter, SparkCBC. Still ahead on Spark, more on our look at overcoming distance. The daily commute in a car can be one of the most tedious parts of modern working life. What if you could be in a car that drives itself? There's a ton of buzz about self-driving cars right now, but how would that actually work? And what would it mean for the way our cities are organized? That's coming up when Spark continues. On last week's show, I talked to Ethan Zuckerman about how to broaden the kind of media we have access to so that we get beyond the if you like this, then you'll like that echo chamber that online media can sometimes be. But it seems that the power of digital analytics to look for patterns and similarities is there to help you when you want something similar. According to New Scientist magazine, researchers at the University of London have developed a system for analyzing the content of a text for the frequency of particular words and comparing them to other texts. So the suggestion is that the system can find consistencies and inconsistencies of style. Now, beyond using it to find a similar novel to the one you've just finished, researchers think it could be used to scan collaboratively written texts, such as television scripts, looking for inconsistencies in style. Inconsistencies in plot, however, is a tougher nut to crack. I'm Nora Young. This is Spark from your friends at CBC Radio. This week, we're looking at overcoming distance. Autonomous vehicles have been in the news lately. Major car manufacturers have plans for autonomous or nearly autonomous vehicles by the end of the decade. This past week, Tesla announced plans to introduce a 90% autonomous car within 3 years. But the thing is, human beings have long had a fascination with cars that could think for themselves. Or at least in 20th century pop culture we have. There was Herbie the Love Bug.
Let's stop kidding ourselves, shall we? This is just an ordinary little car.
I don't think you should have said that. Herbie's very sensitive about his appearance.
And that magical, lovable car, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
What an unusual car.
Daddy made it.
At just the right moment, Chitty could decide to fly and float on water. It took independent action to save the day when needed.
What's happening?
No!
Oh, look at that! It's fantastic! Oh, you're a genius!
And later on, the ultimate self-aware automobile, Kit, from the 1980s TV series Knight Rider. Kit was a car that could be driven, but would also drive itself when necessary. And Kit had a voice, so it meant he was also a friend, with an ego and a sense of humor.
Now, for a collection of microprocessors, you're awfully touchy.
Wrong. It's just that my circuits function better when we operate in a reality mode.
While a car that's your friend slash crime-fighting partner isn't high on the R&D list at auto companies right now, nearly every major auto company is working on an autonomous car. In pop culture, the autonomous car arrives one day in the world as it is and magically transforms people's lives. In reality, things are messier. A major new technology involves more than just the gear itself. It means changes to the culture, how we relate to each other, and to the technology. A while back on Spark, we talked to Clifford Nass. He heads the REVS program at Stanford, where they look at the past, present, and future of the automobile. Here's his take on our future relationship to autonomous cars.
We begin to a very large degree, start having to think about our cars as teammates in achieving goals. And that turns out for humans as well as cars to be rather difficult. We've all had people we've worked with and partnered with where the experience has just been fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
And we've all had experiences in which it's been absolutely terrible.
Uh-huh.
For a number of different social reasons. So as we design these cars, we have to bear in mind all those different social dynamics that make teams successful or unsuccessful and act accordingly.
And that's what we're going to spend some time talking about today. There's been tons of hype about autonomous vehicles, but what are the social hurdles we need to overcome before we can accept self-driving cars as the norm? And what would life in a typical city be like with autonomous cars? First things first, though, how do they even work? Well, it's all about sensors. See, there are roof-mounted lasers. And these are to generate detailed 3D maps of the surrounding area, which are then merged with maps of the world. Based on that, the car calculates how to proceed in a given situation. Some autonomous cars may be equipped with radar devices on every bumper, which help anticipate the distance of the cars around you, especially on the highway. No more having to worry about keeping two chevrons apart, or even having to worry about what a chevron is. And there are also cameras. One camera could be near the mirror to detect traffic lights. These sensors, all collecting data which feed into the car's computer, turn the automated cars we drive today into the autonomous cars of the future. All right, so now we know what an autonomous car is. What's it like to ride in one?
My first ride in an autonomous vehicle will definitely make my top 10 highlight reel for my career. When you sit in the car and you engage the autonomous functionality, and the vehicle starts to speed up, and it automatically puts the blinker on and goes to pass, and it gets into a safe distance behind the next vehicle. It's a real, really interesting first-time experience,
yeah.
And I would recommend it to anybody.
That's Jim Pies. He works at Toyota, where he deals with future products like autonomous vehicles. Jim says we pretty much already have the technology needed to make autonomous cars. As is so often the case with fast-changing technology, it's law and culture that are lagging behind.
Say within government, you know, in the U.S., we have three states that have passed laws, but none of the laws really address issues like fully defining what autonomous is. Liability is an issue. If a autonomous vehicle were to collide with a pedestrian, who would assume the liability of that? Would it be the passenger in the autonomous vehicle, the manufacturer of the vehicle, the insurance company, who?
In addition to legal issues, there's also the problem of how long it'll take us to trust having self-driving cars on the road.
Trust, I think, is the biggest issue of all. Trust in the technology, as in, would you trust the lives of your children being driven to school in a driverless vehicle? Many people right now are nowhere close to that trust level.
And that's why Jim predicts that it will be at least a generation before autonomous vehicles are ubiquitous. And that means a transition period where cars will slowly become more independent from their drivers.
For instance, I could see some autonomy in heavy traffic, for instance. You know, the technology of cruise control combined with automatic braking and combined with lane keep. You know, if you can combine those technologies with software where you could stay in lanes and stop and start with traffic at low speeds, that seems like a logical first step, maybe, you know, that for coexistence between the autonomous and non-autonomous. You know, Toyota also believes that in the future, if we ever get to a fully autonomous, but partially autonomous, that there always needs to be a driver behind the wheel, because you never know when, you know, a construction site might come up and a guy with a red flag. And gosh, there's a lot of red flags in Toronto.
Yes.
Waves his flags, and there's not an algorithm for that. You know, so you have to be able to push the button, disengage, or, you know, tap the brake.
So that's if a driver is always in the autonomous car. But what about the scenario of an empty driverless car?
You're in your vehicle, your autonomous vehicle, driving to work. And you look up and look around you and you see five vehicles that surround you and there's nobody in any of those five vehicles. You know, is that an issue that you would be concerned with regard to the waste of energy? I think that the utter convenience of autonomous vehicles will create additional miles being driven by individuals. Maybe I could use a funny example. If you've ever had that midnight urge for ice cream, you know, and you're sitting watching TV in your pajamas, and then say, I'm in my pajamas. I don't want to go to the local store. Now you could say, well, I'll send the car to get my ice cream.
Yeah. Right.
So will there be frivolous use of autonomous vehicles?
But say we were to sort out all the legal issues, the trust issues, the just plain freaky issues, we're still going to have a transition period where we have our old-fashioned people-driven cars amidst the autonomous ones.
There'll be a life cycle of non-autonomous vehicles that we couldn't ask consumers to just
throw away.
So there'll be this interim period when there'll be autonomous and non-autonomous.
Yeah.
And that will take another... You know, the average lifespan of a vehicle is 12 to 15 years.
None of this is to say that Jim doesn't believe in the technology. He's just trying to be realistic.
It is the future. I'm the biggest believer in autonomous, but these are the things that we have to pass through, these gates, and it's not going to be soon.
Which, if you're waiting for your own version of Kit, the friend/crime-fighting car, is bound to be a little disappointing. Or even if you're imagining yourself in your very own self-driving car right now.
I am heading to my office with my self-autonomous vehicle, fully autonomous vehicle. I get off, tell my car to go park itself. Now, that parking space could be on the street. It could be in a parking structure. It could be much farther out of the area. All of those things are possible when you don't have to be right adjacent to where you work.
But don't assume you'll be commuting in today's 10-seater minivan. Jim says that once these cars can weave themselves through traffic, they're going to shrink.
For one thing, if you realize, you know, in a generation, the benefits of full autonomous and that being accident-free, so rethink the design of the vehicle based upon that. If you're accident-free, do you need all of the safety functionality within the vehicle? That adds cost, weight, time, energy. So I think by nature, the cars can become smaller. We also see that there is a growing demand for vehicles that are very small. We sell an IQ vehicle that's fundamentally a two-seat vehicle. It's a little bit more than half the normal footprint of, a Toyota Avalon or a Lexus. But we're also designing vehicles that are even smaller than that. Some you know, we introduced at the Geneva Auto Show a vehicle called the iRoad. And the iRoad is a tandem, single-seat tandem, you know. So one seat and one seat behind, has three wheels. The front wheels articulate. It has the shelter and maybe safety of a vehicle, but it has the mobility of a motorcycle. And these vehicles can easily become, you know, the vehicle that could perpendicular park in a, you know, on a city street and have two right next to each other and save an enormous amount of space.
Jim, thanks so much for talking to us.
It's my pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me today.
Jim Pies is the corporate manager of North American Business Strategy at Toyota. Now, I have to admit, I've been a bit of an autonomous car skeptic. Not so much about the technical capability. It just seems like it's directing a lot of resources at improving the individual car when the problem is actually much bigger: how to move people around in increasingly large megacities with congestion and pollution. But Research suggests that autonomous cars could be part of a new vision for what our cities look like.
I'm Ryan Chin. I'm the Managing Director of the City Science Initiative at the MIT Media Lab.
The City Science Initiative is a network of research groups looking at the design of technology and infrastructure for cities. And a big part of that research is to find ways to improve how people move around in cities. So Ryan is looking at self-driving cars from a slightly different perspective from the automakers.
Well, I think the commercial operators are very focused on manufacturability, cost, reliability, and following all the safety rules. Our research is really looking way beyond what the industry is doing. The industry is probably looking between 2 and 5 years. Our job is to look way beyond that, 5, 10, even further ahead. And we have to look at new trends, what's going to be disruptive in terms of technology and strategy.
Ryan and his colleagues at MIT are looking at the big picture of how the self-driving car will help shape our cities in the future. But like the automakers, he sees autonomous cars as a disruptive change that's probably inevitable.
Primarily because the costs are going down, the sensing is going up in terms of its ability to sense the environment, the algorithms to control the vehicles are actually getting better as well, and then there's a whole smart cities movement, which is basically making your city smarter through sensors and having access to cameras, for example. If those autonomous cars have access to those types of sensing from the city rather than just on the car, then you have a whole network of access, which allows the car to begin to collaborate, to talk to each other, to talk to other vehicles, and potentially to pedestrians too.
Can you talk about that a little bit more, about the relationship between having sensors in our environment and the workability of autonomous vehicles?
Yeah, I mean, the main cost for autonomous vehicles currently is the big sensor that's on top of the vehicle, and that's a big LiDAR detector, which is essentially a set of radars that spin and make a picture of the environment around you. But that cost is going down because more and more companies are invested into autonomy and the sensor cost is going down. But if you want to really get that cost to near zero or to $500 or $1,000, then you really need access to really good GPS, good maps of the environment, and the ability to talk to the infrastructure in the city, signal lights, cameras, all those things that are in the environment that the city probably wants to have anyway. And often many cities already have traffic cameras in place, and you want to have access to that. And it's really just about access to it.
Yeah. We were talking to Jim Pies from Toyota, and he referred to autonomous vehicles as a shiny object, meaning that there's a lot of hype around them now. I mean, certainly they're very cool, very futuristic. But beyond that, what are the sort of actual practical benefits of something like that?
Well, an autonomous vehicle is going to be much safer than how humans drive. The number of accidents caused by human error is huge. About two-thirds of all accidents are caused by human error. And human error is either from being impaired, you know, drinking, texting, distracted driving, texting, also telephone calls and so forth, eating, sleeping, all those things are human attributable to humans directly. The other third of accidents are actually indirectly caused by humans in poor road design, poor vehicle design as well. So autonomy can directly address those issues by being able to follow the rules, humans are not really good at following rules generally, and also being able to collaborate. Cars can start to talk to each other. As they start to talk to each other, they can start to platoon, follow each other very closely to improve throughput through a particular point in space. Autonomous cars won't stop to see an accident, for example. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you can imagine that if you can talk to a traffic signal or if you can talk to a camera at an intersection and there's no cars coming the other way, why should I stop? I should just continue going, And eventually what that does is you can have an autonomous intersection where traffic signals and lights go away. They don't actually need to be there because cars are starting to talk to each other. Hmm. You'll have to obviously add the layer of communication to pedestrians and bicyclists in cities.
Yeah.
And that's actually some more research going on, both at MIT, but other places as well.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a bit about what potential autonomous cars have for changing the way we think about how we design and use our cities?
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at car sharing, which is now really exploding, particularly in the developing world and also here in North America, the biggest problem with car sharing currently is that the model is problematic. You have cars that you rent at one place and drop them off somewhere else. and this one-way rental of cars, and it happens with bicycles too, basically you put the cars end up in the wrong places, and so not where the demand is. Autonomous vehicles with car sharing allows you to redistribute the vehicles without having people move them around. And when you solve that redistribution issue, then you start to begin shifting people away from private automobile use to something where it's just shared. And when you have shared mobility, you start to affect congestion. You have less people on the road in private automobiles, more people taking transit, more people taking shared vehicles that get you to transit. And therefore, you can design your city in a much more compact way, a more walkable way than what we have today, which is very highway sort of dominant.
So do you think it might change our sort of psychological relationship to cars? Because a lot of people have a great sort of emotional investment in their cars as a sort of a symbol of their personality or a status symbol of that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that certainly the people that want to hand wash their cars, own their Ferraris, buy the nice BMWs, it will still exist. And I'm a car fanatic. I love cars. Mm. And I think that private cars will still exist. They will for some time. When you buy a car now, you'll be there for 15 years at least. So it's not going to go away. But I think the need to shift away from personal private ownership, and it may be that a family may have two cars, now goes down to one because they can use a shared vehicle for most of the time, and that one vehicle is sort of used on the weekends. Or there are young urbanites that want to move out of the suburbs into the city that don't want to own a car at all, and there's significant droves of this Generation Y group that want to do that and use transit and use on-demand mobility to get around. And certainly the autonomy part may be the key to unlocking the potential, I think, of expanding these shared services. And most of them are still very small currently.
Mm. So how would you characterize the current state of autonomous vehicles?
I think it's in sort of the high-tech mode where we're developing the technology. The costs are still high. There's still testing. A number of automotive companies have said, you know, stated publicly they want to have vehicles available autonomously capable by 2020. We have some vehicles now that are semi-autonomous, you know, so they have adaptive cruise control where you get on the highway and it basically, you know, controls up to a certain point. You have self-parked cars as well. So I think the step forward to full autonomy is a real potential, and Google and other companies have already really invested heavily in that. I think that another sort of interesting step is the idea of an autonomous valet, where when you want a car, you call a car, and the car actually arrives to you, no one in it.
Right.
It sort of crawls to you, and then you get into the car, and you actually drive it. And then when you drive it somewhere else, you get out of the car, and then it autonomously parks itself.
Huh.
Or perhaps it autonomously recharges if it's an electric. And ultimately, you want to have the car then go to the next customer. So, you know, you pick up and drop. It's just like a taxi cab. So it's almost like a self-driving, autonomous, electric taxi cab. And that, I think, for cities makes a lot of sense because of land and also congestion.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like we have the one issue of the technology of the car itself, but then it does sound like we need this sort of infrastructure, this way of thinking about the city as an intelligent grid and that kind of thing. Do you get the feeling that this is something that cities are actively pursuing and thinking about this?
Yeah, a number of cities have put out RFPs for smart city technologies. You know, the number of companies that that develop smart grid technology, others that do smart charging, others that do smart traffic monitoring. All cities are looking at that. And the key to that is that most of that is about optimization. It's trying to optimize the existing infrastructure of the city through digital technology. And certainly, I think that's the first step. But a revolution, of course, would be to get away from these existing models. So I think it's not only sort of evolution through optimization, but also revolution through new systems that can be applied to the city, new models.
So when we talked to Jim Pies, he was suggesting we're looking at maybe a generation from now that you would have fully autonomous vehicles on the road. Does that seem like a reasonable timeline to you, or what do you think?
I think a generation is good for ubiquity of autonomous vehicles, but that doesn't mean that we can't get them out there earlier. You know, Google already has an autonomous car. It's driven, half a million miles or whatever they've gone already. All of the car makers have either secret projects or publicly disclosed projects in autonomous vehicles. I also think having the cost of these things go down, that's going to happen too. Right now, if the Google car may cost in the order of $200,000. Back 3 or 4 years ago, MIT built an autonomous car and it cost $500,000. And that cost is going to continue to drop, especially if you can combine it with low-cost sensing and then access to city infrastructure. Because the more you can take out of the car in terms of hardware and software and sensing, and the more you put in the environment, the better it's going to be, the cost will go down. And those sensors that are in the environment are not just for cars, it's for the city itself in terms of pedestrian flow and other things that they want to check out. So I think as a kind of collective thing, you're going to get much more benefit and therefore have autonomy become useful mm-hmm. very quickly.
Ryan, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Ryan Chin is the managing director of the City Science Initiative at the MIT Media Lab. As we heard from Jim Pies and Ryan Chin, autonomous cars require more than just a change in technology. They'll require a change in our relationship with that technology. And that changing relationship with tech is something we'll explore next week on Spark. For instance, I talked to the author Brian Christian about the way we relate to artificial intelligence software, personal assistants like Apple's Siri or Google Now.
We create these pieces of software to be non-subjective. When we ask our friend what his favorite movie is, we're deliberately asking someone who has seen a very, very small percentage of the total movies that have ever been seen. But when we ask IMDb or Metacritic what the best movies are, we're deliberately going to this aggregator because it has seen every film ever. And that, I think, marks a very real and very important difference. Software is not expected to have a point of view. And so there is something a little bit strange when, for example, Siri will crack a joke or say something sassy about its rival AI programs, because we don't expect software to have opinions at all. Google has, in the last 4 or 5 years, done a lot of really interesting work on moving from a general best algorithm to an algorithm that's going to tailor the search experience, for example, to every particular user. That's also a failure by my standard of subjectivity, in the sense that you're moving from this completely objective aggregate of all data to an experience that's meant to basically give the user their own subjectivity reflected back to them.
Yeah.
And that's the subject of books like Eli Pariser's The Filter Bubble, this idea that, you know, we might be moving unsuspecting into a future where we think we're interacting with some other entity, but in fact that entity is doing its darndest to be us.
And maybe that's why I had the experience recently of getting a little personalized Google message saying, you know, your commute to work is going to be 5 minutes late or something, predicated on the assumption that I would be driving to work, but I was walking to work. And I immediately reacted with a feeling of sort of irritation. And maybe that's what it is when you see those cracks in the mask. You realize that it's not really telling you anything about yourself. It's just spouting off certain assumptions.
There's also the indignance that the phone has GPS. Shouldn't it know that I walked to work at a rate of 4 miles an hour? That
right.
You know, isn't it safe to assume I'm not driving at that point?
Driving very slowly. That's Brian Christian, author of The Most Human Human, What Artificial Intelligence Teaches Us About Being Alive. I'll talk more to Brian next week when we explore contextual computing, common ground, and whether it's possible to fall in love, actually fall in love, with artificial intelligence. The self-driving car and always-on video connection are good examples of a broader feature of new technologies. It's not just about the thing itself, it's the context in which it exists. You can't just bolt on a new technology to an existing culture. How we adapt to the technology and in turn shape the future of the technology is cultural and political. The good thing is that when a technology is new, we see the trade-offs and changes involved. After that, much as was the case with the adoption of the car itself, what was up for grabs quickly starts to seem inevitable. That's it for Spark this time around. The show was made by
Michelle Parisi,
Dan Meisner,
Kent Hoffman,
and I'm the intern, Armonic Bali,
and me, Nora Young, and by
Danny Robinson.
Saul Greenberg.
Julian Treasure.
Jim Pies.
And
Ryan Chin.
Find us on Facebook or Twitter, SparkCBC. I'm Nora Young. Until next time, home, James.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.